Good morning, everyone, and welcome to today's edition of FarmCon Conversations Podcast. This is Todd Leckler, along with my good friend Kevin Van Trump. Kevin, how are you doing today, sir?
Doing good, buddy.
Awesome. Anything exciting happened your way over the weekend at the Van Trump house?
No, nothing out of the norm. No, we had the grandkids, and you guys, I heard, were up there worried you might have some fire problems. What were you outside with the hoses and? Got pretty close to you guys, didn't it?
Earlier last week, we went out and let the dog, or opened the door and let the dog out, and I thought I'd left something burning in the trash can, and anyway, long story short, that's when we realized fires were happening. Mom was monitoring on Facebook, and then Saturday or Sunday, we drove north, we're just south of Oshkosh a little bit. Anyway, drove up to what's called Crescent National Park, and I sent you some of those videos, and it had been burnt over and two, but I tell you what, the firefighters did a hell of a job of protecting the properties there because it was so weird to see nothing but black and then the yellow white circles of the grass around properties. And there's not a lot of properties, but it was impressive work there. So now, yeah, it's still out of control, but about 20 miles north of us at this point in time. So we're it's over 740,000 acres. This is the largest in Nebraska history. I guess the fourth largest in the country. I mean, it's all across the state. There's four major fires right now that are occurring, and they're all across the state from just north of me on the west, on the eastern part of the panhandle to central and stuff. So it's
you guys are just still dry. You're just still dry as can be, and
dude, it's horrible. Yeah, I mean it's really bad. I mean, we're D3, nearing D4 out here, and I mean, I saw on the internet there's fires down in Texas, Oklahoma, stuff. So we're a red flag. It will be that way for a while. So it's just going to be touch and go. I imagine the winds are going to be 20, 30 again today. So it's just not easy. But yeah.
Yeah, you got 60-70 mile an hour winds there. When I talked to you this weekend, weren't you?
No, it was. It was horrible, dude. Yeah, they shut down. I sent you one of those tweets. I can't remember when I sent it. I don't know if it's past or if we're going to go in next time. But, I mean, the entire state of Nebraska, half the highways were closed because of fires. Half of them were closed because of blizzards. it was crazy, dude. But, no, they had winds over 100. They showed these. My wife showed me. They showed 18-wheelers that they shut down I-80 west of Big Springs because of the winds coming out of Wyoming. And they showed trucks being knocked over that were parked is how high it was, windy it was blowing. So yeah, it's been pretty crazy right now, but springtime on the high desert, man. So
I hear you.
Here we are. All right. Well, what happened yesterday? Soybeans.
We had a wild week. Definitely a wild few weeks, I think, in the markets. So you know, I think Todd's referencing what happened on Monday with the limit down move in beans. And I think the funds, like I said, the funds were holding the record, net record large position, long position, excuse me. And, whenever they're holding that much length, it can be dangerous to the downside if they get something that spooks them a little bit. So, obviously, I guess the talk that Trump and the White House made to lay the visit to China with Xi, I had the markets on his heels a little bit. And I think there's some talk that, maybe the RVO could be delayed a little bit too. I'm not really sure on that front. You had Brazil and China kind of, there's rumors that they've been, I guess, lowering their standards a little bit on some of the requirements that they used to have on shipping some of the beans into China. So it appears that China's loosening up a little bit their guidelines to accept more Brazilian beans. So that doesn't appear to seem as if they want to buy a great deal of American beans. So, I've been kind of making that argument for a while. I mean, hell, we've been saying that for several years, right? It looks like the China's trying to become less and less reliant on U.S. agriculture, and they're trying to do that through South America and through their other entities or partnerships they have around the world with into Africa and into other areas. So, I mean, I don't think that's anything we didn't know, right, Todd? I mean, it seems like China's been making that pivot for a while. So, I'm a big fan and proponent that we've got to find more ways to use our own U.S. agriculture And we can't really be relying on China being the one big buyer of beans. And I think that's what we're trying to do. I mean, I think that's what you're seeing with some of the new legislation, some of the new pushes, some of the new crush facilities being built, what we're doing with the renewable and the bio side of with the bean oil and some of those things. So, you know, I think we're heading the right way. We had a record crush for February, and actually it was a record crush for any month. And so I think domestic crush looks good. I think the USDA could bump crush higher, anywhere from 5 to 25 million bushels. And, you know, but net-net, does that really put us in a majorly bullish market with prices up here? You know, we were north of 12 bucks. And I don't know. That's where I'm saying I don't think the domestic demand is strong enough as of yet to do all of the heavy lifting that would be needed for prices to stay above $12, Todd. So, you know, I think it's great that we have a nice, strong, and growing domestic crush, but global supplies are near record large. I think Brazil, you know, is getting ready to, you know, they're, what, 60, 70% harvested on another record crop. We're going to plant an extra, not an extra, but in comparison to last year, we should probably plant another 4 to 5 million acres of beans this year. So, net-net, there's no real supply-side story. So you got to look at demand. And, I don't think the Chinese demand story is a bullish story. I think it's actually a bearish story to some degree for the United States. I think China's economy is struggling. I think it's weakening. I think the Chinese officials are looking to pivot away from being, like I said, being reliant on U.S. ag. So I think they're trying to buy as many beans as they can from other sources and use us as an ancillary supplier, which is understandable. I mean, it makes sense. So I'm just saying I don't think we can look to the Chinese as our bullish driver, especially with what we're seeing happen here geopolitically, with what we go into Venezuela, we go into Iran, and we're talking about taking Cuba. I mean, I got to believe we're ruffling the feathers of the Chinese here. And so I'm just saying. I don't see it as a bullish driver, Chinese demand. Even if they took the additional 8 million metric tons, I still don't see it as a bullish driver necessarily. I think maybe the trade would, and you'd have a knee-jerk to the upside, but I don't see it because, you know, it just is going to push more of our what we would have typically sold to other countries, and now Brazil is going to source that. So net-net, there probably wouldn't be that big of a change to the whole overall balance sheet. That's what I've been saying. You know, I think the funds are plowing in here maybe a little. I don't know. I think they're a little overexcited about the Chinese, and they may have added a little too much risk premium in on the Chinese thoughts of additional Chinese buying. So we used that opportunity to price more bushels. Long story short, you know, we were sold out of old crop beans. We're about 35% priced in new crop beans. We had next price targets up there in Nov 26. I think we're around 11.90, somewhere between 11.90. And 12 bucks, we're looking to price a little bit more to get the 40% price. We priced some more corn last we priced another bit of new crop corn at 4.92 when our price target was triggered there. That gave us 30% price of estimated new crop production. We priced a bit more of old crop as well on the rally. I'm hoping to price something with a 5 in front of it. Hasn't happened as of yet. D26 new crop got up to, I think, somewhere around 498 and a quarter, and then kind of backed off a little bit. You know, hopefully we'll get another run. We catch a spring weather worry here in the U.S. I think there's a chance we could, because I just got this feeling that fuel prices are going to stay a little bit elevated, maybe a lot elevated. And, you know, that's got the funds wanting to be a little bit more long and aggressive in these grain markets. So maybe there's a shot here in corn if we can catch some type of weather worry. I think we're going to have Gary Lezak on, not this week, but the next, to kind of update us on what all is going to take place and his outlook on this spring and summer weather, and see if there's some plays there that we may be needing to make, or some shifts in the overall marketing. So as far as wheat, Todd, we priced some more wheat last week as well, you know, feathered in a few more sales. I think I just continue to say I like using the rallies to price more bushels. I think our last wheat sale was up there at 640 on that big move higher that we had. And it's the same type of story. I worry that U.S. exports in wheat are going to be able to be the bullish driver moving forward. I think we're going to have some bigger supply side worries and supply side stories. Now, I think we do have a little of that brewing, though. If you, I'm going to ask you your opinion. I mean, you know, we've had this, we had some more extreme weather swings. We've had some crazy cold temps here as of late. Now it looks like we're going back to the 80s in some areas. You know, and I think that's put stress on the wheat crop in some of these areas where it's gotten a little more advanced. And you've had the fires, you've had the extreme winds, you've had hail, you've had just quite a few things that could eventually have a drag. We'll see eventually a drag on the wheat yield. I don't know that for sure as of yet how sizable that drag would be. But there is a little bit of, there are some weather stories brewing in some pockets. You know, wheat's up here at some elevated levels. You know, some of the spreads are a little out of whack. Hard red may be a little, gotten a little bit ahead of itself in comparison to soft red. But I don't know. There are a few weather stories brewing that maybe that can play to fruition. My fear is just this, Todd, in the wheat market. Where are the bullish headlines going to come after we get all the bears out of their short positions? And that's about where we've gotten. I mean, we've had this rally, but a lot of it's been a short covering rally. And so you got to sit there in your head and say, okay, what's going to attract new bullish money flow to replace this short covering rally, or else prices are going to pull back? It's got to be weather, in my opinion. I think you got to have the weather because the dollar's, you know, the dollar's rallied and it's become stronger. Shipping and freight rates have become more expensive. I just don't know if we're going to be the leader on the export side necessarily. So I think there has to be some supply side stories, and that's going to have to come from weather. So I don't want to sound like a broken record, Todd, but same old story. I think right here it's weather in Washington, and that's going to be the leading actors for the next, what, 6 to 8, 12 weeks here. So, you know, and that's what we're really going to dial in and try and pay close attention to. But we want to price some more bushels if we can continue to rally into some type of a weather or war or Washington headline. So that's where we sit.
Well, let me ask you on this wheat thing, just so I'm clear. Are you saying that the current potential weather worries are what's created the bear short cover
I think you had the war. You know, I shouldn't call it the war. The military action in the Middle East had people a little bit worried. He had a few things. When that typically happens, maybe it shakes some of the funds that were, they were holding some pretty fairly sizable bearish positions in wheat, whether it was against corn or against other commodities. You know, short wheat was kind of the leg they wanted to play, and long corn, short wheat, long beans, short wheat, however the combination was, slice it. But regardless, there's been some headlines and some change in sentiment that is taking the funds out of their short positions. You know, now they're net long corn. You know, they're really exit a majority of their short wheat positions. And I think that could be because we are heading into a little more of a weather market. You've had some weather worries, so that may have spooked them out a little bit. They've taken a more just overall tone, bullish tone maybe towards the commodity sector. And we've seen some rotation. Maybe they're rotating a little bit out of the, you know, you've seen the rotation into the metals and then into the energies, and the rotation from maybe now the energies maybe into the grains. So, you know, I don't know, they're rotating the money around here a little bit. I'm a little apprehensive, though, because every time I know, each time, like, we had this huge plowing of money, you know, I said the funds were made one of their biggest weeks for, you know, buying corn. I think it was last week. And, you know, I went back in history, look at the top other four or five times that's happened. Well, we broke after that. We didn't rally. I mean, you broke. And so, it's hard for me to sit here and be wildly bullish when we're this overbought to the upside from a technical perspective. Like, as you know, I mean, I feel like we're a little, you know, we're well above the 200, you know, in the major moving averages. We have been anyway. We pulled back here after Monday's limit down moving beans. But obviously, I felt we were overstretched to the upside. A lot of the funds had already covered their shorts. A lot of the funds were already in being aggressive longs. And so then, you know, who do you have left to come in and be a big buyer? And what headline is that going to take to attract those people? I don't see it right here at the moment. So like I said, I think we drift back lower. Maybe Trump goes into China and negotiates a few more deals. Maybe You know, that creates another leg up. I don't know. Or maybe there's some weather issues or scares that come up this spring that create some uncertainty. So we'll just have to see as how that plays out. So I love the position we're in right now from a marketing perspective. The market gave us a chance to get caught up and get back on where we'd like to be. And I think, you know, 30-40% priced here going into planting. We like our position there. We got a good amount of wheat covered. And, you know, I think everything's right where we would want it to be if we could have written a good picture. So I like where we're at.
I think the market gave everybody a chance to get caught up. I just hope they took it. So anyway, as far as the wheat goes, what I'm seeing on the condition of it, I mean, I would say that if we do not end up seeing pockets of production issues lowering, it'll be the first time I say that wheat has 10 lines instead of 9 lines. Because yeah, there's a lot of areas that's getting beaten around bad. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. I wanted to ask you on, you know, you made the comment, we need to find more ways to
do it. And I should tell, I believe we'll start getting those first, those weekly crop condition reports from the USDA.
That's right.
Those come out like the first week in April typically. So, I mean, they're just around the corner, you know. And then we've got the planting report coming up on March 31st and the quarterly stocks on March 31st, and then we'll start getting those condition reports. So, you know, within the next 2 or 3 weeks, you're going to start to see a lot more headlines that are going to move the market a little bit here. So,
well, let me ask you, and I do not know how they go about acquiring that data for the 31st, planting intentions and stuff, but do you think, I mean, let's just say that data is already collected and they missed collecting the guys that are switching eggs. Is that a possibility?
Well, that's always possible. You know, they'll have their revision in June, and then they'll revise throughout the year, and you get acreage changes. And just, but you know, a lot of that comes from, I believe, I don't know if this first one does, but it's crop insurance data, RMA, you know, different places. And so, you know, I think it's going to be in the ballpark. You know, but they will make some adjustments if you know, weather changes come up, fertilizer goes nuts, something like that were to happen and cause a major shift or change in the acre. So, you know, I think initial estimates are probably fairly close at this point, but I guess we'll just see what happens. What are you hearing?
Well, no, I was going to say, I guess I was surprised. I've learned the last couple of weeks, because initially 2 weeks ago when we made a comment when the war started, I sent out a bunch of tweets, this and that, and, you know, hey, this is going to affect you, this and that. Nobody, everybody had what they wanted. That's 15 farmers across 8 states, and it's only been recently that I've been reading and talking to people that, no, man, I mean, there's still a lot that needs to go down. Now, it all seems that it's here in the states, inventory-wise, so it's just a matter of
what
you're
saying nitrogen, or what are you talking about?
Yeah, sorry. All the nitrogen products, they're all here. It's just a matter of what you're going to pay for and stuff. So, I mean, I think we're easily going to see it. Potential million acres change by the sound of it, but I guess we'll wait and see what the real numbers come out and trade those.
And that's kind of the question. I mean, everybody's been penciling in. We jumped higher by 3.5-4 million acres. So now instead with the war in the Middle East and the higher input costs, some people are saying now we could pop by 4.5 to 5 million acres higher, you know, and somewhere in there, yeah, you know, for beans. I'm not going to debate. I'm not going to say no, that's for sure. Now, I was a little worried when we traded limit down, and then I thought, well, shit, we traded limit down 2 or 3 more days. Well, now you might be a different story, but you know, it looks like we've maybe stabled some things out here and just had that knee jerk back to the downside. And like I said, if it's really a demand driven market, you know, maybe you'll rally it back higher. I'm still holding puts, Todd. I got lucky, put on a bunch of put position. I was buying a bunch of beaten up puts on the rally the week before, and just started accumulating a fairly decent position, at least for me. And boy, we broke. We went limit down. I couldn't have been more happy. And I just looked out there and I took about a third of them off and banked the profits, and that paid for all the other positions. So now I'm just in a position to, you know, no cost or no risk. And I'm going to let them ride. They're out in the deferreds. They're in the Julys, and you know, so they're range anywhere from, I think I got everything from 1180 puts down to, you know, somewhere 1150, 1140 area, and so a bunch of different ranging ones. And so what in different ways I played them, but regardless, yeah, I don't know. I mean, I feel like fundamentally that there could be some disappointment here with the Chinese situation or some of the other things, and that maybe we have a pullback. So that's how I'm going to play it.
Yeah. And before we move on, let me just say, and you did correct me. Thank you for doing that. I made the comment of saying yesterday instead of Monday. So thank you. We'll get better at that. All right. Well, let's move on, brother, to our stocks, trades, and other investment areas right now. And just kind of get us up to speed on if anything in the last week has changed your thoughts or positions.
No, not really. I mean, you know, I was short a little bit. You know, I had some shorts on just to try and cover some of my risk and some of my equity positions, just some hedge-type plays, and those worked out okay, worked out well. Markets pulled back a little bit. We've had a little bit of a rally higher here in the last couple of days, which is good. I've been adding to some Bitcoin on the break. I lightened up my gold and silver positions quite a bit last week. You know, I'm just sitting there in my head, and I'm like, these markets got over. They got well overstretched from my perspective. I like them longer term, but I sit here, and I'm like, you have a massive military action in the Middle East, and especially with two powers like the U.S. and Iran. And that really didn't excite any – it didn't attract any more money flow into the gold and the silver market. And – from my perspective, that shows me that we probably run out of a little bit of juice here on the buy side. So, you know, I started to lighten up when I saw that the gold and the silver didn't react the way I thought it might react. I thought it would actually pop higher off the, you know, the announcement of the military action in the Middle East, and it didn't. So that kind of spooked me out. And then, so I just reduced my position way down and just going to watch it here. I think we could have an even more larger break nearby, and then, you know, I'd probably look to add into it on that. But I've been nibbling on a few of these beaten up bank stocks, the Blackstones, BlackRock, and you know, keep an eye on Goldman. I've been long Goldman Sachs for quite a long time. JP Morgan, I guess if they get beaten up more, I'd probably add, but I haven't added as of yet. But I feel like a few of those things may have gotten a little bit, you know, maybe a little bit overdone to the downside. I'm just, like I said, starting to build some smaller positions on the breaks and the pullbacks in some of those. So we'll just have to watch them and see how they play out and go from there. But, yeah, no, I haven't made any big adjustments. I took some weight off in the XLE or my energy stocks, like bank profits. You know, I think longer term there's probably some more upside potential, but we've had one hell of a run, and I just don't want to get caught up in the big rotation back the other way. So, you know, bank profits there, and just kind of sitting now, just like I said, I'm probably anywhere from 30 to, depending on which account, my trading accounts, I mean, I'm anywhere from 30 to 50% in cash, I'll just tell you that. So some of them are right closer to 30 and some in that 40 to 50 range. So I'm just kind of sitting here, got you know, I'm in some CDs, I'm in some other things that are earning anywhere from 3 to 5%, and just kind of watching it and seeing how we play out here. I just told Jordan last night, we were talking on the phone, I said, hell, sitting some of these CDs and I'm clipping 3 to 5%. I mean, the best case, my opinion, now this isn't anyone else, this is mine. I'm not sure there's much more upside potential in this year's S&P than maybe 7 to 8%. But if I can earn 3 to 5 with no risk, I mean, I'm going to sit here and risk, you know, I don't feel like sitting here and risking the farm to make and clip an extra 3 to 4%. So, you know, I'm geared a little bit more, I guess I'm just less risk adverse right now. And I just think there's a lot of things in the underlying landscape that could cause a 5 to 20% drawdown in the market, especially in a midterm election year, especially with the underlying landscape, especially my consumer might be a little stretched. All I'm saying is, and I don't know if we end the year there or anything, but I think you could see a 5% to a 20% pullback. From where, and I think that's a buying opportunity, you know, and I think there's some places to put more money to work, and that's what I'm looking to do. So, I'm staying fairly conservative until we see that. So,
well, I definitely agree. Boy, I mean, the headlines sure line up for something to happen on the correction side with everything that's going on, midterm elections, labor issues, and all that stuff. Hey, I wanted to ask you, I want to go back and revisit this your reduced gold position and stuff, only because I was shocked, and once again, we're talking to a rookie investor here. When the war started, I'm like, hey, hell yeah, man, I'm in gold. This is going to be great. And then I look at it, and I'm like, what the heck? And, you know, the things I'm reading, so clarify my thought process, because I believe this, I guess, now, or I'm accepting this as truth. that, you know, a lot of the reason for that was, you know, in this specific set of conditions, oil, you know, near $100 a barrel, and then which leads to potential inflation, which leads to then the Fed not making cuts, which leads then to the dollar getting stronger and less money going there versus gold. So, one, so far, do you agree with everything I stood there as it plays out?
Well, I think you had gold prices that have been on one hell of a run, and they were elevated as can be. So if I'm sitting out there and I'm managing money and I'm looking for a place to get a little safe umbrella over my head, the dollar had to help. You know, dollar had shit beat out of it for the last several weeks or months, and I should say, and gold had been extremely elevated. So I'm going to probably run some money into the dollar just from that perspective, and also from the perspective, like you said, I think you're hesitant probably to be in gold in the bonds just because the yield may be a little bit impacted the way this is going to play out with the Fed and this possible stagflation, so to speak. Has the Fed maybe boxed in a little bit with weakening labor and the bump higher in inflation? So, yeah, you know, I that's what I'm saying. I can see why gold didn't pop. And you've seen Bitcoin kind of pop and the dollar pop, and they were both kind of beaten up quite a bit. So, you know, yeah, and that's what I'm saying. That led me to believe, I'm like, I just think, you know, gold and silver maybe could just drift here for a while, sideways to lower. And there's probably another opportunity to buy some more or add to that at a little later date. So, yeah.
Is for you, once again, correct me if I'm, is there a correlation for the dollar index, as it goes down, gold will go back up? Or, I mean, is that full stinking?
I mean, you could make some correlations, I guess, but I don't know. I certainly wouldn't use that as my proxy for staying in a position or initiating one. I mean,
so do you have any comments? Do you have any comments on the resiliency of our Bitcoin here recently? It's back trading up in the mid-70s. Everybody thought it was dead.
No, I mean, I still think it could go down into the 40s myself. That's why I was telling Jordan and the kids, I just like, you know, we've built back a decent little position here, but we didn't have near what we had on at one point several years ago. But, as we get higher and higher, I mean, there, you know, what I don't know what your potential becomes. You know, it's just – you know, to be a 10-bagger from here, you're going to have to be 700,000, you know. So it's, you know, I don't know. I think there's other plays out there in the stock market that you probably have a better chance of getting a 10-bagger than you do in Bitcoin. So I have some, like I said, we have a position and some exposure to it. I don't have a full position on by any means, and I still think there's a chance we'd break down into the 40s, give me another chance to buy a little more if you're looking to be a longer-term player. But, I think if we could 2x it over the next 5-10 years, that'd be an okay return from my perspective on what I have invested in it. So, I don't know. It's purely a speculative play in our portfolio, and
right.
See how it works.
Me too. Yeah. I just find it interesting watching it. Well, it looked like it was taking a dead spiral there last 4 to 6 weeks.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And I've read all the bullish recent reports that are out and why we're rallying and because of this. And because, you know, I don't know. I mean, like I said, I don't even know on the whole damn thing. And I haven't from the time I was trading it when it was below $300. So it's like it's something we've traded. We've gotten lucky, I feel like. And I know and understand all the bullish thesis and things, but if it went to zero, I would say, yeah, probably. I mean, you know what I'm saying? I wouldn't argue if someone told me it was going to end up at zero in 20 years. I wouldn't argue with them. And I wouldn't argue with the person that told me it was going to be at a million in 20 years. So I truly don't know. And that's what's, you know, so crazy about it. And that's
well. I just recall that I just recalling now for some reason I saw a headline maybe 3 days ago or so that some they're making moves to at least certain people are making moves to so the government can't do their own form of a digital dollar, which was a bullish headline for crypto, so maybe that helps a little bit there too.
Maybe.
Yeah. All right, so let's just kind of get going to the macro now a little bit. And regarding this whole thing, and we, I think a lot of people out there on the internet, maybe saw the Substack thing run around called the Entrap, and we're going to get into that. Basically, it just talks about the extra consequences beyond just oil and stuff from the Strait of Hormuz being closed. But just where we are now, your current thoughts on, you know, where we are with the issue. And, I mean, you talk about the Feds, you know, coming out with their deal, their comments, because, dude, we know inflation. I believe inflation is going to go up, in the obviously, and then energy and then food. And then give me your timeline. I mean, what's the lag effect here? Okay, we shut the war off today. I mean, I'm hearing different things on how long it's going to take to restructure everything to get flows back. So just paint us a picture of what you're seeing here for, you know, the near future and then the Fed making.
Yeah, you know, I don't know. I listened to President Trump this week talk about Cuba next, and, you know, him going, you know, him wanting to go in and take Cuba or do whatever may happen with Cuba. I mean, there's similar type of play that I think granted Venezuela, Iran, and now Cuba. And I sit there in my head, and I'm like, you know, maybe this is part of a master plan to really, I guess, garner some negotiating chips with Putin and China. It's like, I mean, they've got to be sitting there scratching their head a little bit like, holy shit, I mean, this guy just went and, I mean, kicked the hell out of, you know, three of their allies that they had aligned. And I suspect they're kind of maybe a little bit scratching their head and wondering, you know, a lot of the military weaponry that they have purchased or that they had bought, a lot from the Middle East, a lot from some of these other sources, certainly doesn't appear to be working as well as they probably thought at one point. And maybe Trump's just flexing and showing that, like, shit, I think you guys don't really have any bargaining chips, so to speak, the way these things are shaking out. So, you know, I don't know. I don't know. I don't get, you know, like I said, I don't want armchair quarterback situation, when I can't have access to see all of the playing cards.
Right.
I think they're doing, my opinion, I'm supportive. I want to remain supportive and of what's happening and what's taking place. I believe that they're making the best decisions that based on the intel that they're receiving. And so, I have nothing negative to say on the front. I think this action with Iran probably needed to take place at any point during the last 20 years because of what I personally, you know, have seen from the intel that I have looked at. So we know Iran's been a major thorn and you know, really American haters for some time. So, you know, I think it needed to happen. And of course, nothing, you know, does anything in life happen without some sacrifice or some type of pain? And no, it doesn't. It's unfortunate. And that's going to piss some people off. But I think it's what needs to happen. I mean, I think I'm just saying I'm supportive and I suspect I'll remain supportive. So if that means higher energy prices here at home for a while, I guess that's the price we're going to have to pay for the freedoms of my kids and grandkids and other things to try and maintain those freedoms. So that's just where I'm at on the whole deal. And, you know, regardless of who was in office, I'm going to tell you right now, I don't care who was in office. I don't care if it was a Democrat or a Republican. I would still be supportive of the issue. So that's just where I'm at. I'm not going to take a stance because one political party's affiliation or the other's. I just think, you know, it's probably prudent that we address the situation just as so much money flows from there to terrorist activity and terrorist type of regimes that really, you know, have one objective, and it's to take out America or take out American citizens. And, I got to stand. I'm standing for that no matter what, that we defend that.
No, I'm with you, and that goes to the point you're always making. You know, I mean, you got to support your team or go change teams, which means leave. But, and this is the pain thing. You said it before. We've talked about it before. There's going to be pain in every situation. In fact, people don't want it. They want to find a solution to avoid it. Creates more problems, in my opinion, than suffering through the pain.
Yeah, and my supporting our team is just this. My dad was in Vietnam, and he came back to tons of, you know, people throwing shit at him and everything else and all kinds of crazy.
Right.
And that's all I'm saying. I don't care who's in office, but if they decide to run our military out somewhere or someplace, I am going to be more than supportive and try to help in any way I can to help those military people and be supportive of their efforts. I'm not going to take the other side and I just can't do that. I can't get my head around that just because my family was in the military and served and were drafted, my dad and my grandfather, and all the way up the line. So it's like I have to support whoever. And what, like I said, just support that cause. So that's where we're at on.
Yeah. One more question in America. I want to leave Canada some deeper implications into the Strait of Hormuz when we get Jay on and get his thoughts as well. But I'm going to call this the stagflation scoreboard, man. So one week later, I mean that from my last podcast. I mean, the Fed has previously indicated they want to support labor, lowering interest rates. But is that even realistic? I mean, anything's realistic. But what's your thoughts if they do that as we are going to go into the teeth of obviously rising inflation?
Well, I think, the market was set up here on Wall Street. The bulls were talking we were going to have one, maybe two interest rate cuts in 26. Some bulls were talking maybe even three. Now that rhetoric's down to a coin toss between zero cuts and maybe one cut. And I think that's probably right. I mean, I think we could see one cut in 2026. I think employment, I think we're getting spooked a little bit on AI. At this point, yes, we're seeing laps. Yes, we're seeing cuts. We're also seeing some areas where we're seeing some gains. But, net-net, I don't believe labor is going to strengthen aggressively. But I'm not sure. I don't think it's going to collapse either. Is the unemployment rate going to continue to tick higher? Yes, I suspect so, to some degree. Do I think inflation is going to get out of control? No, I do not. I mean, hell, a couple of years ago we had $100 crude oil. So it's like, I don't think it's going to get wildly nuts. I think Trump has his eye on the price at the pump. I think, we'll probably do this dance a little longer. But, I just don't think we're going to see inflation set back in and become entrenched. Now, I could be wrong. I could be wrong on that. There's people out there saying that, we're going to have the third wave come up, and it's going to be just like we've seen in the 70s and in the 80s where we had the farming crisis, and this is going to be the next wave. And then this wave of inflation is going to be a real doozy, and it could really bite. And then you're going to see the Fed start to eventually raise rates. And hell, there's people talking we could be back to 15-16% interest rate, and you got a lot of doomsdayers out there. I don't think that's going to happen. I don't see that in the crystal ball anywhere, at least in mine, but I'm also talking my position. I don't want to see that happen. So, maybe I'm biased against that, Todd. So, yeah, there's a lot of that talk out there, and you look at some things, and the setup is in place where you could have that. You certainly could. I think that's why you've got the gold bugs and the silver bugs, and everybody on the bandwagon to load up on the gold and silver and the talk of hyperinflation and these type of things. I think people love to sell those stories. They make a lot of money selling those stories. And if you look back through time, the odds of it happening are pretty slim. It just doesn't happen too often. So I can't put my money behind that at this point in time. I mean, I think you got to be prudent. I think you need a little gold in your portfolio. You need some silver. All of those types of things. I think you need to own things. I think all those things make sense. But I'm just not a doomsdayer, so to speak. So I think they're going to reel this in a little bit. And I think price at the pump is going to come back down in 6 months, somewhere in there. And away we go, hopefully.
Yeah, I just want to touch on what you said about getting a little spooked on AI. And there was actually an article written the other day about the two CEOs that are kind of spooking the world a little bit. But then, you look at what we published today, two tweets that we published every day that show, if your job consists of sitting in front of a screen, you got to believe, you're at high risk of things happening. But, Meta laid off 20%, is going to lay off 20% of their force. I'm just, once again, and I'm sure we'll touch on this for, a couple seconds every week just to kind of keep a running scoreboard of it, but, how much of this we're still looking at, getting rid of all the leftover hires from the COVID pandemic, or, is this AI now? So, anyhow, it's definitely...
I told Jordan the kids, I bet you dollars to donuts that, boy, every CEO out there, in my opinion, is got to have a target on the back of all these work-at-home people, and that are just on a screen, right, and working from home.
Yeah.
Those people don't have much legion to the business. To, you know, they're not big, you know, cheering and diehard. You know, these are job jumpers. A lot of these kids are job jumpers. They don't have any loyalty. They're working from home. Well, I'm telling you right now, if I'm a CEO, I got a target on their back. If I can get AI to replace them, I'm replacing them. And so I'm just telling you, from my perspective, I think you're going to see massive cuts across the board on all of the work, on that work at home. You know, those would be the first people that I think are going to be in trouble looking for jobs, just because why not, right? I mean, why would you have that payroll expense? They're not even coming to the office. They're not even supportive. I just don't see it. So
I just like to put on the record that I am a 5-year veteran of work at home. So I'm not a job jumper, but I do work at home. So if I'm not here next week, you guys just heard why. All right, Kevin, move
definitely.
On.
I thought that was funny.
Hey, I thought that was funny. Okay. All right, I'll work on my joke. All right, I think we're
going to
– yeah, I'm going to – Jay, are you on board? Mr. Felton?
No? Did you send him the right time, Todd? Did you send him the right time?
No, I did, 10:15 Central. I'm going to text him while we keep talking. Okay, that's fine. No big deal. He'll pump on. I'll give him a quick text. Hey, listen, we haven't done a perspective section for a while, you know, kind of things you cover in Story 3 and this and that. But actually, this one, 2 days ago, we ran this interesting article, Behind the Curtain of America's Big Lie, and you know, that we were told, you know, they were so divided, this and that, but the reality isn't there. And you wrote some good stuff on that, and I wanted to get to let you simply.
I thought it was interesting. And Todd just talking about the article where, you know, it talks about how a lot of people aren't what we think they are. You know, I mean, I think people – but I'm an eternal optimist. So, you know, I'm of the belief the people are good still, and that there's a lot of great and good people out there, and that the media, you know, the media tries to just make us – not just the media, but social media and all of these algorithms. And I almost feel like it's Russia and China just constantly trying to divide us and constantly trying to put out headlines that – you know, they know we're going to divide us. And I've said that for 10-15 years, that, you know, we're starting to be defined more and more by what we're against, not what we're for. And, you know, there's a lot of things that we're all collectively for and that we all agree on, whether it's family dinners, you know, together. I mean, everyone, you know, I think regardless of your race and political affiliation, you know, we all want to try and do what's best for our families. And we all try to, you know, we want to be together and we want to be around the family and friends that we love and do those things. But that isn't what any of the media or any, like I said, the social media is about. It's about more dividing us and how all that plays out. But I think that's all bullshit. And I think there are really a lot of really great people that are willing to help their neighbors and are willing to cross party lines and are willing to give people hugs and say, hey, I respect your opinion and I respect it. But we all we see is this hatred and all this craziness. But I think it's because, you know, that's how the media is. That's how they make money. That's how they get more loyalty. That's how they sell more things. And, you know, and so, you know, like I said, Todd, I think the more we could get off and quit looking at all that type of craziness, the better off we'd all be. So. You know, that's my opinion. Right?
Boy, wouldn't that be nice. All right, after a tremendous technical rigmarole, I believe I pulled the right levers. Jay, are you with us?
Nice try, Todd.
Jay, unmute. Jay, unmute. No,
maybe.
He told me he's on.
But we could be having problems with our dial-in, just because sometimes, you know, if they have high wind or something in the area, there could be some issues on that dial-in, so.
No, he's stuck on the Google world. I send the calendar invite so they can block it on the calendar, and I tell them I'm going to send you an email with the information to call him. He's on the Google world right now. I'm trying to get him back. So.
He just needs to dial, but not.
I know.
Yeah, you need to dial. But regardless, it is what it is. I'll go ahead and talk. You talk to see if you can get Jay on there. But
yep, give me 30 seconds.
Yeah, and so moving forward to our – but just looking back on that corn, bean, wheat types of positions, how we're playing that. you know, I went into this setup. So let's rewind. Let's go back, say, three or four months. I was thinking the corn bean market, we're going to break lower. I had some buy orders in beans at around 1020. We'd sold them, and, you know, we got down to about 1050 and never got down to 1020. And I had some buy orders in on corn down there lower. We didn't get to it around where it was, around that four area, just below there. But we didn't really make it to there either when I had the order. Then we took off to the upside, and I was wanting to be bullish kind of going into the springtime. Well, then we had this massive rally, and I just couldn't – I couldn't handle it just based on a balance sheet play. And so I thought we needed to get bearish. And we sold some up here. Like I said, we made some short positions, put short positions on last week. And, you know, I think we could pull back. And maybe the funds overdo it to the downside. You know, maybe they liquidate too much off. I don't think so in this space, just with crude where it is and in the underlying macro landscape where it is. But, if we were to pull back quite a bit more, I would look then probably to put on some type of bullish position in this range just in case we had some weather issue or weather worry. So that's what I'm saying. I think there's some built-in support here underneath. But, you know, you could go out there. I think yesterday there were some guys out there selling. You could go into July and corn and say you could sell 520 calls and buy 450 puts. So I'd give you a floor at 450, capture upside at 520. But net-net, you could get it on. I think day before yesterday, you could do it at no cost. So it break basically even money. But like I said, give you some type of floor. I think you got to be talking to your local grain merchandiser, your local, your personal advisors, just about using the rallies and trying to reduce some type of longer term price risk on those rallies while we're in this space. Just because, like I said, these war markets tend to trade like weather markets, and they can just be real fast and furious to the upside and even crazier to the downside, like we saw earlier this week with the limit down move in beans. That's why I'm saying I think you need to be working with your people, whoever you trust on that front or whoever you use on that front, to be trying to get some things in place in case this were to just kind of collapse and fall apart, like weather markets often do, that you'd have some downside protection. So that's just, I think you really got to spend some time thinking about that right here and use these rallies to our advantage. I'm not saying we can't go higher because we certainly can, but I'm trying to get you some safety nets in place to protect that downside a little bit. Todd, any luck?
No, it's all good stuff. Now he's not even replying to my text. I'm not sure what's happening. So
maybe he's in bad coverage too. So.
He should be able to text me and tell me that he's not.
Todd, I'm right here.
Jay!
I'm taking
good
notes.
Morning, Jay.
I'm taking notes, and setting my positions up.
Attaboy. we're going to keep on moving. So I'm going to do a quick intro, Jay, so we can get into it because we got a lot of good stuff to talk about. So let's get this ball rolling. All right. We got today Mr. Jay Felton. Jay is a partner at Lathrop GPM in Kansas City, where he leads the firm's agribusiness and food industry group. With over 20 years of experience, Jay specializes in high-stakes commercial litigation, product liability defense, class action matters, and regulatory investigation. Jay is also a fifth-generation Missouri farmer and rancher and remains actively involved in his cattle and row crop operation. Jay, good morning, welcome, and thank you for taking the time today, sir.
I appreciate it. I'm not just on today, but I listen regularly to the podcast and appreciate the chance to be on with you guys this morning.
Well, let me tell everybody for due transparency that Mr. Felton is, in fact, Kevin's personal, or at least one of them, attorney. Jay's a good friend of the Ventura family, supported FarmCon, and just been a good friend to everything that we do. So Jay's got a lot of unique angles of perspective, but we're going to start with some fun stuff real quick. Jay, I was just made aware of the fact that just fill us in on your uncle who trained some important horses and had some winners and et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, actually my great uncle. It's actually, I think it's my first cousin once removed, was Jimmy Jones. And he and his father, Ben, grew up in Parnell, Missouri, where I grew up in Maryville. And they trained thoroughbred horses, first in Parnell, then in Kansas City, and then for an operation in Kentucky called Calumet, where they had six Kentucky Derby winners and two Triple Crown winners, and kind of dominated the 40s and 50s in horse racing. And I was fortunate enough to grow up with Jimmy as kind of another member of my family, kind of like another grandfather to me. So I grew up hearing all those stories and learning all about horse racing, thoroughbred horse racing, which was a far cry from the horses I rode growing up taking care of cattle.
Oh, that's pretty cool. I heard he passed down some pretty some neat trinkets to you that you might still be holding on to.
Yes. I have most everything. Jimmy was a very good curator of the Jones memorabilia, and it went mostly to the horse racing museums Kentucky and New York, and to a hospital that he helped help fund up in Northwest Missouri that was important to him. But a few of the things are adorned family member walls, and he was generous enough to give me a few of those things that are in my office here at Lathrop if you ever swing by.
Awesome. I've been there. Hey, Jay, I'm going to tee you up with a softball to start with, but you got a unique perspective, my friend. You're a fifth-generation farmer rancher up in Northwest Missouri. You do what you do for Lathrop GPM. And, I mean, how does that unique vantage point shape your view where farming's headed for the next 5 to 10 years, especially as corporate-level risk and innovation, you know, are increasingly influenced what's happening at the farm gate? Just kind of throw it out there and give your view, babe.
Yeah, it's fascinating. It's very humbling to me. You know, we have a very modest row crop operation compared to the real operators that are out there. And I grew up working primarily cowboy and taking care of the crops secondarily. That's changed to now focus more on the crops. But I learned a lot by working with some of the best and brightest in ag in all facets of the industry. And so, again, it's pretty humbling to me. To understand how it all comes together and how all the pieces on the board matter when it comes to modern agriculture and how critical it is to, frankly, to be curious and be current and be nimble and got to work hard on that every day. And that applies to our operation up in Northwest Missouri, applies to my practice here at Lathrop.
And hey, yeah. Todd, I want to preface a couple things just for the listener. Jay represents some biggest names in agriculture and defend some of them in court. And so I love hearing Jay's perspective and just a good, great guy, great family, and has a really strong background. And like us, Jay, kind of tell him, I always love the story when you tell me how you kind of got your job when you're out in the cotton field, and tell him that story real quick.
Yeah, well, I'll just, my one caveat, I speak today is on behalf of myself and not any of my clients, including the one I'm talking to. I'm speaking only for myself and not for my firm or any of my clients. But I grew up, again, cowboy and taking care of a row crop operation. And with a lot of folks, the farm wasn't big enough to really have another family of four kids. It wasn't big enough for us to all come back and farm, so I needed to go do something else. And wandered off and ended up in law school, which was great. Decided to come back to the Midwest and not stay out east. And really great, really glad I made that decision. But I got back here and all of a sudden was trying cases at a firm at Lathrop here, a much smaller version of Lathrop. And there was a phone call for a lawyer from a company down south that needed to talk to a partner who was no longer at the firm. He was dead, so he wasn't going to take the call. But they needed somebody that understood a farm, and the head of litigation came by and said, well, you're a farmer. Can you take this case? I said, sure, and took the case, and we won the case. I didn't think anything of it, but a couple of years later, they had another problem and called me to go down to the Boot Hill. And I went down to the Boot Hill investigating a problem, and we were standing in a field with all the executives and all the smart folks, and a guy walked up to me and said, what do you think – what do you think this cotton's going to do? And I said, not very good. We're in a soybean field. And he said, well, I guess we found our lawyer. And so I don't know if that made any difference. I don't know much about cotton at all. I know a little about soybeans, but I knew we were not in a cotton field. So anyway, you never know where it's going to come into play.
I hear you, buddy. I hear you. A little common sense goes a long ways, doesn't it?
Yeah, a little ways, but it's been fortunate. I still represent that client today. That was over 20 years ago.
Awesome.
That's awesome. I'm going to push a little bit back on that first question, and I appreciate the answer that you gave. But from where you sit, brother, and looking where farming maybe is going, I mean, you work with some of the biggest companies. Are there programs being set up? Are we seeing the the premiums for regen and sustainable stuff? Or is it going to be about tech and AI? We'll get into some more AI stuff. But, I mean, are you seeing the roadways where maybe the best of the best are going to go first to stay relevant, to stay ahead of the game?
I mean, we all want to focus on quality and reliability, but in the end, it's going to be efficiency, right? So, I mean, anything we can do to be more efficient if we're going to continue to produce commoditized crops. Kevin's hammered that home every farm con I've been to, but we're still doing it. I'm still doing it. So if we're going to try to produce and make money and really have some sort of a decent ROE when it comes to corn and soy, which what I'm trying to do, only way to really make that work is to be efficient. To do that, you got to innovate, because you can't just run the same play. And you got to manage your costs, and you got to look for ways to be more efficient. And that's going to happen a lot of different ways. I think AI is part of it. I have a lot of thoughts on that, but I think you're going to see different opportunities coming up depending on what the government does with the programs on regenerative ag. And you're going to see a lot of people trying new products. That's going to be impacted by the Durnell case. Frankly, new product innovation is going to be impacted by the Durnell case that I talked about at FarmCon. It's currently up in front of the Supreme Court, because I think the current law is, I think, inhibiting some of the innovation when it comes to herbicides and pesticides, because companies are afraid to launch it.
That's one of my questions. Go ahead and go deeper on that, because that was one of my questions later. But since you brought it up, just tell us, make sure everybody knows what that is, what the both sides are, and where you think it's headed.
I think I put people to sleep at FarmCon on this, but
You got 90 seconds. They won't go to sleep in 90 seconds.
The Supreme Court granted cert on a case called Durnell versus Monsanto, which is based out of Missouri, where a person had non-Hodgkin's lymphoma and claimed it came from Roundup, and claimed that the Roundup label, which was FIFRA-approved label, did not warn sufficiently of the risks associated with the use of Roundup. Durnell was awarded over $1 million at trial. That case has been moved up through the court system, and now is in front of the United States Supreme Court. Monsanto is arguing that the FIFRA label should preempt a state law failure to warn claim. That would overturn a case called Bates, which goes back to 2003, where the Supreme Court said you can have state laws that are in play on failure to warn cases so long as they're parallel to the federal law. The dissenter said you're going to have a patchwork quilt and you're going to have an avalanche of litigation, and the dissenters were correct. We've had a patchwork quilt of different states with different rules, and we've had a lot of litigation. So the court's taken it. If the court takes it and somehow reverses Bates and puts the FIFRA preemption back in play, that will give the companies that do make these products and do put warning labels on that are approved a defense to state failure to warn claims, because they have a FIFRA label and they follow the FIFRA label warning, the restrictions on that label. So it's really important, because you put a bunch of money into a product and launch it, and you got a label and you want to use the fact that the label tells you everything you're supposed to do and warns you about all the downsides to using it. They want to use that as a defense against state law claims. And that is potentially back in play.
Gotcha. No, thank you. I mean, can I ask you, do you favor just one regulatory body at the federal level versus states being able to do that, I assume?
I favor consistency and certainty, because I think American agriculture can win anywhere all the time, so long as you have consistency. In other words, tell us what the rules are, apply them consistently. That's all we need. And so I think the problem with the patchwork quilt of every state having different rules and regs makes it harder for us to be consistent, makes it harder for the supply chain to provide and innovate and give us the products. I think having the federal FIFRA label having some meaning is important, and I think that's what where the court's going to go. I hope that's where the court's going to go.
Yeah, no, I no doubt.
Do you see some big, from a personal perspective, Jay, do you see some big changes coming down with glyphosate and how we're in herbicide, you know, in the herbicide and how we're tackling weeds and some of these things? Do you see stuff in the pipe?
Yeah, I think, Kevin, obviously there's new things, well, at least one new product coming along. But I think if Bates gets reversed and you can get a FIFRA label that gives you some protection, I think the pipeline will open back up. I think you'll see more things come on, and it'll accelerate investments into the area. And I think you're going to see it. Anyone that's innovating with any type of a product in the herbicide pesticide area, where there could be any claim of any type of human exposure, is looking for this is main herbicide and pesticides where this is going to affect people. But in those areas, they're going to want to have a label. If you have to have a FIFRA label, you're going to want to have that FIFRA protection. And if you have it, I think it's going to make you more likely to put money into investing into new products. And we need that for innovation.
Yeah. All right. So speaking of innovation, Jay, are you seeing anything? You seen any innovation in that stuff? Because we know there had been a whole lot of mode of action changes for a while, and it takes a long time to get some of these things. So are you seeing anything on the forefront fringes out there that so there may be new ways besides robotics to attack?
I think you're going to see, I don't know where biologics is going. I don't know if you're talking about that or where, I think it's going to be a lot of different people are going to try a lot of different new products to see how they work. But I think from a systemic perspective, I think AI is going to have a big impact because I think it's going to eventually allow us to integrate a lot of the data we have and help us, save some expenses on the margins. And, if we're going to, again, be in a low-cost provider marketplace, anything we can do to increase our efficiency helps us drive up our ROE. And I think AI will help combine all the data points we have.
Do you have an opinion? Hold on, Kevin. Kevin, I know where you're going. Jay, do you have an opinion on how much efficiency dropping to the bottom line that AI can help with farmers that are operating their business like a business?
I think you could see. I've seen the smart folks saying this could be a 10 to 20% reduction if you utilize it properly, in some of the input costs, and that could come by just integrating your decision making into your equipment. So you're applying your fertilizer at different rates. So you're applying your herbicides and pesticides at different rates. And maybe reducing your overall use. So I've heard people say 10 to 20% reduction, which is real dollars. We're not there yet, right? But I mean, if you could reduce my fertilizer or my herbicide pesticide cost 10 or 20%, that's real dollars.
Kevin, sorry for interrupting you, but what would you throw in there, my friend?
No, I just had a couple of things. What the hell is that investment I'm in with Crisp? What are they doing with that pesticides and herbicide?
And Jay, I was not talking about biological specifically, but about what you're seeing. But yes, Kevin, on that
that's
note,
not
are you talking about Quercus?
Yeah, but that's a different type of that's not biological. It's something else.
No, they're taking. So I'm allowed to talk about this?
Well, to some degree, go ahead, but not.
I'm just going to say I can say what they're doing. Is that yes or no?
Well,
they're simply making protein. They're using AI to make proteins that essentially, the simplest way to put it, is what takes 5 to 10 years to create, chemically do and test and get approval. They're doing in 6 months, I believe, is what the time frame was to maybe up a year. But apparently they got the. What's the word effect? It's effective. They've got it's going away. It looks like it could be. It overcomes what biologicals fail because this is attacking.
It provides more consistency, right? More consistency.
100%. I just didn't know. I was hitting around to see if Jade been hearing anything on the innovation front in that regard.
I've thrown some money at it. I think it's pre-A round, pre-seed. I don't know. I threw some pre-seed money, I think. But, it's pretty interesting. But, again, there's so many people out there trying to do things in the herbicide and pesticide. So, I mean, I think it is going to be interesting how some of this, the legalities play out and how that kind of may influence or, like I say, push us one direction. Maybe it's a benefit. Maybe it's a hindrance. I don't know yet. That's what I was trying to pick Jay's brain. On some of these other investments I'm in they're trying to find alternative sources for glyphosate. You know what I'm saying, Jay? They're trying to come up with ways that if glyphosate goes bye-bye, what are we going to use? And so, I've got some thrown in a few of those. Hell, I don't know if those ships ever come home or they just keep needing more money.
We've already seen AI deployed in the high-margin businesses in pharma and the like, right? So there's no reason why they're not going to wander into ag and start using some of those AI models to try to test different approaches to some of the problems we have. And if they can come up with new products and test them that way and accelerate the pipeline, it'd be huge. Again, coming back, not to be a broken record, but if you're launching a company and you have a new herbicide or pesticide and you're afraid that your label's not going to give you any protection, it's going to make you a little less likely, right? Yeah. So we'll be watching what the court does with Durnell. But I think you're going to see AI back in helping come up with new and different ways of doing things and new and different ways of testing them. So it may not take you 10 years of tests. That'd be great. Yeah.
You know, where Todd and I argue, Jay, is, you know, Todd's shit. He's a big, huge proponent or fan of AI. And I'm over here, you know, from a producer's perspective, you know, my opinion is it may help a few folks. But, I mean, a lot of the people that, you know, if you're underwater or below water or you're really struggling, I mean, yeah, I don't think AI is anywhere you need to be over dabbling in. You got a lot more low-hanging fruit or fruit on the ground you could probably be dealing with than that. And I tried to equate it to what I said to Todd. It's like, I see a lot of these kids today come out here and shit. You know, they don't have any money saved. They don't have a house purchased. They don't have a Lambo. They don't own a car. They don't but shit, they're wanting to go out, Jay, and invest money in some wild-ass cryptocurrency that I don't even know what the hell it is. You know, and what I'm saying is that isn't the way to becoming a great investor. I mean, you're just looking for a get-rich-quick scheme if that's the case, and you're not doing the process. You're not going through the proper process that would make you a good longer-term investor. You're looking for a quick route. So all I say is don't look at AI as like some savior that's going to come down here and change your whole operation. Your next thing, you're just going to be a great, oh, you're a profitable producer now. I don't believe that for one bit.
No, I'd rather disagree with you. It's more fun, but I agree with you 100%. So let me riff on AI for 90 seconds, Todd. Can I do that? You know, AI is, I used to teach a class at the University of Missouri on the 2050 world, and I was teaching AI 20 years ago and, of course, missed it. And my former students now call me up and say, you were right about AI. Why didn't you tell us to invest in NVIDIA? But AI has been coming for a long time, right? It's already been disrupting businesses for a long time, including law. So, but when we look at it in ag, you know, we got to remember what AI is and what AI isn't. AI doesn't think. AI is kind of like Cliff Clavin from Cheers. It's going to always give you an answer, whether it knows whether it's right or not. And it's going to be absolutely completely confident in the answer it gives. It's going to tell you what, but it's not thinking, it's guessing. This iteration of AI. But this iteration of AI that we use today is the worst version we're ever going to have because it's going to get better and get better tomorrow. So it's going to keep getting better. So in ag, I'm going to go for the Goldilocks option, okay, which is going to AI and thinking AI is going to solve your problems on your farm. It's not going to work. Not right now. Not this AI. It's just a tool. So I think if you adopt full adoption of it or investing in it or going whole hog into it is ill-advisable for most operators. On the other side, ignoring it and pretending like it doesn't exist and it's a fad, also not a good idea. So what I'm encouraging people to do, again, is be curious and keep current and, you know, utilize the basically free AI tools, not necessarily for farming, but just making sure you understand and getting the reps in, understanding what AI can and cannot do. And in the end, you want to be Goldilocks. You want to be right in the middle, right? You want to be fast to follow when something gets established. When there's a way to properly integrate all your data into an AI model to help you make decisions, it's not there yet, right? But ultimately it will be. You want to know how to use it so you're not trying to learn on the fly. So just, again, I can't tell you a magic AI tool to use or what to invest in, but I can tell you be curious and keep active and keep thinking about what AI can do in ag and see how the innovation works. And if it starts to work, then you can be a fast to follow and be a Goldilocks person.
Jay, do those thoughts you just made hold true when you throw AI agents into the mix?
Yeah, of course. Because those AI agents are only as good as the people that train the agents, right?
Yeah, but okay. But you made the comment that, you know, AI doesn't think. And I understand what you mean. But hell, half of the processes that run the mundane aspects of business don't require thought. They require execution or action, meaning that if you get these AI agents going, running 24/7 for you on their sensors, put it on one space, give them a crypto wallet. They're sitting there buying your inputs for you at the best price, sourcing them. They're making the trades, putting your hedges on. That ain't going to make a difference in my operation.
And when they're wrong and you call me, who do I sue?
Yeah, why don't you do that, Todd?
Oh, you guys are looking for Utopia.
Hey, let us dummies over here know how it works out.
All I'm saying is Goldilocks, Todd. Goldilocks. You know, you don't have to say it's not going to come, but you don't have to go whole hog into it.
No, and I'm just going to be pro.
And I got to tell you, this is one area people are arguing about is crop scouting, for instance. You know, they're just going to overfly with drones or satellites, and they're going to use AI, and that's going to replace it. Not if you have a really good crop scout. It's not. What's going to happen is a really good crop scout that has AI tools is going to be better than a really good crop scout without AI tools.
Exactly.
So it's a tool. It's just another tool. But you got to have somebody smart wielding that tool. You know, me swinging a hammer versus somebody like Kevin Van Trump swinging a hammer, you know, he's going to hit that nail better than I can.
100% agree. Let me ask you that. You just kind of touched on something we talked about earlier that we're in the early stages of. Do you have any thoughts or knowledge or awarenesses of, you know, what will be the new jobs that this new technology creates? It seems like every time there's a new technology, everybody worries about decimation of labor, but then there's new jobs created no one thought about. You got any sense of, besides being prompt and code writers, I mean, do you see anything yet or hear anything from the people out there that are forward thinking?
Yeah, it's a hard time to be coming through college. I've got a brilliant son that's sophomore at Mizzou, and you know, he's doing engineering and physics, and he's covering his bets. You know, you've read recently they're going to always, we have a shortage of engineers, and then you read recently that they're not hiring engineers. So I don't know. I don't think it's settled yet as to what the secondary and tertiary impacts of AI are going to be. I think it's going to settle out, and there will be new jobs and new opportunities. I can tell you the one thing that's very clear is AI is not going to replace. We just got obliterated by a hailstorm. Not going to replace the roofers. You know, they got construction cranes going all up over Kansas City. It's not going to replace the people that are building those buildings. You know, there are a lot of jobs that are going to continue to be out there and be in high demand. I think that anything that is repetitive and can be, you know, digitized, you know, could potentially be not replaced, but one person can do more work with those tools than they could 5 or 10 years ago. So you'll still have jobs. You just won't need as many people. And we're seeing that in law. I'm seeing that across a number of different clients. That's what's happening out there. People are doing more they're doing more work with fewer people.
Yeah, definitely on that deal. Hey, I want to move to a broader subject that Kevin and I kind of left open so that we would bring you in, because you sent us some information last night on a Substack on an article titled The Nitrogen Trap. And, you know, we're seeing, obviously, with the closure of the Strait of Hormuz, there's a lot more than just oil that's not going through. This article made, and I'm going to let you go into it, but it just kind of made a nice case, a big case for that there could be some food issues. So, and then there's timing issues, which maybe can Kevin and Ty talk to you a little bit. But just give us your perspective on that whole Strait of Hormuz, what it's going to do, what we're seeing down there, if you got some insight on that, plus, you know, find that article.
He's a good follow. I think he identifies the issues. He doesn't really take a position. I think for us, U.S. producers, it's not a supply issue in 26, I don't think. As a practical matter, you're going to get your potass and your DAP and your MAP, and you're going to get your nitrogen, whatever flavor you want. You're going to get it. You probably already either have applied it or you bought it, and the people that are going to get it for you have already stocked it. So it'll be a price issue if you didn't buy and didn't set yourself up and don't have your contracts in place. And I don't think that suppliers, there'll be a hard time for them to use force majeure here, because it's really not going to affect the U.S. supply chain. And it might. I mean, I guess in some of the urea comes through there, but you know, I think it's going to be primarily a price issue for the people that didn't get their contracts in place for the U.S. In 26. If this thing moves past the 4th of July, it could start impacting prices for the fall fill, which, as you both know, starts in August. You know, they start, you know, putting back all the different things that we need to do. But in the end, again, Kevin's the expert, but potash comes primarily from Canada. And the phosphorus rock, phosphate rock, comes from Morocco and Russia and China. And, you know, we can turn that into DAP and MAP here. So, I mean, that's not really a problem. And we got plenty of natural gas to crack to make anhydrous or urea or UAN. So the U.S., we're pretty fortunate. Now, that's not the case for other parts of the world. I mean,
right.
this is not coming at Brazil and India and sub-Saharan Africa don't have the domestic production of the fertilizer components, and they don't have the supply network and the storage network we have, at least to the best of my knowledge. And at least for Brazil, their growing season is coming at a bad time for them. And they got ships that need to be headed there now that aren't going to be heading there now. So I think it's going to be disruptive potentially and affect crop choices in Brazil for this season, for one of their, I guess their next season, they're double cropping. But so I could see impacting there. Mainly it's if this thing goes past the 4th of July. That's an arbitrary date. But I think if our supply chain is so resilient in this country, I think we'll be fine if things are back to normal by then. If it's not back to normal by then, you're going to see a lot of price issues.
So, when you say resilient, you mean that the distributors can get it, but the farmers just have to pay for it.
Sure, and you know it's fascinating to me. I mean, you're reading what I'm reading. I mean, you've seen the Department of Justice start doing inquiries into different pricing mechanisms, and you've seen a whole lot of different lawsuits getting filed out there. So there's a lot of attention to the fertilizer supply chain right now. You know, I got to tell you, I'll sound like a defense lawyer, but I'm just telling my
really?
Personal opinion. People aren't going to go. These industries are not high margin industries, and they require massive capital to be able to deploy them. And we're lucky we have them. And that's why the Department of Justice has allowed these companies to continue to grow and acquire, and that's why they have the market share they have. So, I mean, saying things like these companies are too big, but the companies are big because they were approved by the Department of Justice. And they were approved by the Department of Justice because the companies require massive capital investment and they're a low-margin business. So I it'll be interesting to see how it plays out.
I tell Todd, Jay, everybody's for capitalism as long as it isn't capitalism on you.
Yeah. Well, that's right. I mean, nobody else is going to say, you know, I got some money today. You know what I want to do, Todd? Let's go build a new fertilizer production facility.
Yeah.
Because it costs, it's highly regulated, highly complex, very expensive, and low margin. So we're lucky we have that. I just said Brazil doesn't have it. You know, they wish they did. We're lucky we do. And that means in this country we won't have a supply issue, we'll have a price issue. I'd rather, if I have a choice as a farmer, I'd rather have a price issue than a supply issue.
No, yeah, well said. I'm just trying to cover all the full spectrum of these things, and you're doing a great
you're,
job, so.
You're a plaintiff's lawyer at heart, Todd. I know. But there you go.
Well, basically, and hey, that's why this will be one of the highest rated podcasts. So let me ask you, I mean, that story started out with the whole premise of, you know, hey, man, they spent 50 years ago, we created the oil, strategic oil reserve and stuff, and we don't have one for fertilizer. Is that necessary, or because what you just said, or the supply chain so resilient, we have it, it just operates a little differently than having reserves right here for fertilizer?
I don't think we need that because of the incredible system we have, and I'm not saying it's perfect, okay, but I mean, we have an incredible system of different producers who can produce what we need, and we have the people that can then store it, and then the people that can apply it. And we have, you know, it works really, really well because we're overlaid. We have the production, we have the rail network and trucking network, and we have the storage facilities where they need to be. I mean, the one area where we're really exposed as a country, and you know this better than I do, but it's potash. Because, you know, those mine salts with potassium are all mined pretty much out of Canada. So, but we generally get along with Canada, and I don't know what else they're going to do with their potash if they don't sell it to us. So that's the one where that's the hardest. That's the one where we can't replace it. You know, the DAP and the MAP turning that phosphate rock into DAP-MAP does require sulfur, and sulfur is a byproduct of refineries. And so you see people talking about that, saying, well, if a refinery shut down, we won't have enough sulfur. I think there's some potential secondary exposure there, but I don't think there's enough to justify a strategic sulfur reserve or something like that. I think we'll be okay.
Well, here's something that just occurred to me, because, I mean, it wasn't all that long ago in my lifetime that, you know, we weren't the number one producer of oil. We didn't have it, and plus there's a lot of regulations on it. I don't even know this. Sounds like you might – I mean, could we – do we have the natural resources to actually mine our own products that needed – sulfur included?
Oh yeah, we can do everything but potash.
Okay.
We don't have the potash. We don't. I mean, you mine salts with potassium, and maybe there's potash mines around here. Maybe there are mines for that around here. I don't know.
Yeah.
Kevin would know, but I don't think we have that. I think the other stuff we either have or we can have if we need it.
Yeah, I was just curious.
I mean, listen, the phosphate rock, we do pull a lot of that from Morocco. That's where most of that is. But we have the phosphate rock if we need it. But we can get it from Morocco. I don't think you need to have a phosphate rock reserve or something like that.
Yeah. So I kind of asked this a little bit earlier. I'm going to kind of see if I can pin you down a little bit more. But, you know, so we're talking on how this current geopolitical shock is disrupting all this fertilizer stuff. From where you sit, as you talk to these big companies that are starting new programs, and as I said, regenerative and sustainability, are you seeing trends like precision nutrient management or regen practices that people are offering that are going to reduce our dependency on some of these supplies? I mean, are there programs being put in place? Are you seeing the Nestle's of the world, General Mills? Are you on that side of things where you're seeing things that are going to make a difference on how acres are grown?
Not yet. I mean, what you're seeing them as are niche products, human consumption products. Yeah, you're seeing them there, but those are niche. Those are small. But that's, I think people are experimenting. One thing is clear. If you show us all as farmers where we can do something for a nickel instead of a dime, we'll do it for a nickel. we'll go. But I just don't think it's there yet.
No, I would agree. I just wanted to get ahead of the curve if there was some. Because I was going to ask Kevin, Kevin, you made the comment on the soybean thing. We got to do more with our homegrown ag. And I'm just thinking to myself, okay, what if the biodiesels and all that stuff, doesn't come through or eventually goes away? I mean, is there even anything else that you can imagine that's talked about, anyone's ever whispered, that what's another crop that can cut into the corn and bean acres? That's when you get rid of corn and bean and produce something else. Is there another product to grow versus trying to find more demand for the same product?
You're asking me or asking Kevin?
If you ask me, I'll ask Kevin.
No, I don't get tripped up in that too much. I mean, like I said, I don't really want to be the first guy through the door. So I'm not a fan of being the first guy through the door.
Goldilocks. Let's be Goldilocks.
You get shit kicked out of you too much. You're first guy through the door. I mean, you're going to take the bullets. You're going to take the punches. And I'd rather be about that fifth, sixth guy, let some guys tire down a little bit up there. I'm not the guy racing out to switch farms over to new crops. I'm more the guy trying to figure out what the hell to do with my money on my good years. On the years that we clip a good coupon, how can I become a better investor? And becoming a better investor then allows me to buy more ground, do more things, have more options. Tell me, Jay, how the hell can we make more money? And let everyone know, preface this first. Jay has been a good, sound buffer for me the last many years, keeping me out of doing some stupid shit. And just to let you guys know, I probably believe that's more important. It's like being a great quarterback, right? To be a great quarterback, you don't necessarily want the quarterback that's going to win the game for you. You want the guy that isn't going to lose the game for you, right? You want the guy that ain't throwing the late picks, the making the bad turnovers, and making bad decisions down the line. So I'm kind of crazy, and I love a good story, and I love all that. But I tend to then not look what would we call it, Jay? I don't look for some of the problem. I just don't look. I look past what could be problem areas. So I like to run things by Jay. And a lot of times Jay will talk me out of doing something too crazy stupid where in years past, I probably would have done them. But and that's what I'm saying, Jay. What are you seeing out there? What are you? What are you doing with your money, buddy? What are you doing? Besides,
that was my next question.
I'm trying to learn. I mean, I learn every day. It's like I said, I'm humbled by the people I get to work with every day, whether they're being in the field or in a boardroom or in a lab, and I learn from them every day. And I've made a lot of mistakes over the years, and I learned from those as well. So I try to follow my own advice. I try to be curious, be current, and stay nimble, and try to take a longer-term play. I try to take some of the things I learned on the farm and apply those to investing, which is, make sure you've proven out, make sure you have a proven plan, make sure and follow the plan, know that the plan's not going to always work, and you and have a buffer built in for that. And so it's to be diversified and to really, look at, I don't know if you read a lot in the Nassim Taleb, but, kind of a barbell approach to where you have your investments that you know are solid, that have a pretty good chance for return. And then a certain percent, depending on your risk tolerance, where you'll take some risks. And those have a chance to be, your 3, 5, 10 Xers. But if they go away, they go away. You just make sure and modulate those and know that those are what they are, and you invest that accordingly. And so, invest as you're looking into it, and also picking your partners. And more and more critical for me, maybe as I've gotten older, is making sure you're in business with people you want to be in business with. Life's too short to do something otherwise. So picking good businesses with good partners is critical for me. And again, back to the farm, back to the cowboy, the main way to make sure your herd doesn't go downhill is to mind the gate. And that's both ways, which is you only let good cattle on the farm and you take the bad cattle off. And you've got to do it at the gate. And so I try to make sure and sort out the bad investments and only let in the good ones. And I listen, and Kevin's kept me from making some bad investments too. So he's returned the favor.
Yeah. Hey, Jay, did you sell a little bit of farm ground, kind of at that peak, 2, 3, 4 years? I don't remember what it was, but
we did because it was logistics because the town had enveloped us. And, trying to run a row crop operation around housing on three sides of you, it was just getting to be. And, we had that farm I owned with my brother and my sisters. And it wasn't a happy day, but, it was also, that land was not priced for row crop when we sold it.
Perfect. It was happy. It was a bittersweet day. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it was, and put the money into other things. You said something earlier about, investing. I think that's the one thing. We probably don't have time to talk succession planning. If you have me back, we'll talk about that sometime. But, I think that's one of the things, if you're really building generational farm versus some other types of businesses, requires a certain economies of scale. So you have to have a certain amount of acres. And I think sometimes farmers, when they make money, decide that the only thing they can invest in is more acres and bigger sheds. And I think you got to really look hard at that. And I would really encourage my producer clients to really think hard on that issue, because, what do you want this farm to look like, 5, 10, 15, 20 years from now? And if you've got somebody that's not going to be involved in the operation, and you got to figure out how to get them, that kid, what you want to get that kid, you need to really have diversified yourself and not just have all your assets allocated to farm ground, which is meaning diversify, which means read the other part of the Van Trump report when it comes and hit your mailbox on how to invest in the stocks and bonds and the like. Yep.
Does that mean, and is this diversification without having to include selling my farmland for data centers?
Yeah. If you can sell your farmland for a data center, the what they're paying for data centers, I don't know. I got to tell you, I'm farming ground that my family's farmed for 5 generations, but if somebody offered me $30,000 an acre, goodness gracious. I mean, are those numbers real? I mean,
what's the price you wouldn't even have to think about? What's the price you wouldn't even think about? It's a definite yes. Is it $30,000?
I don't know, Todd. Yes, if you're offering $30,000, I've got I've got some I'll sell the hill ground to you for 30 the bottom for 50. How about that, Todd?
There you go.
That works.
Well, no, I was just going to ask if you how much I didn't know how much experience maybe you got from professional or personal in dealing with this or seeing this happen and playing out in that regard because
I'm not in the data center space, so I don't know how they're pricing okay. that. My major concern with data centers from an operational standpoint is making sure that we have the in place properly and we have the power grid in place for them. But because I got to tell you, I think the cloud data centers are 15 or 20% built out, and the AI data centers are about 8% built out. So we're not even close to having what we're going to need to have. And people can say we don't want to have them, but they're going to have to go somewhere. Because AI is going to be replacing and doing all this work for us. I don't want to have the AI centers in a country that can flip the switch and turn them off for us.
100%. Do you are you a proponent then of that they need to produce their own energy in whatever
absolutely.
Form that is?
Absolutely. And they need we need the long-term players. They got to be long-term players. If they're going to put infrastructure in place, they need to have skin in the game to do that. And most of the big companies are doing that. And I'm not betting against the NVIDIA geniuses and the other geniuses out there for coming up with chips that don't run quite as hot. And if you can figure out a way to have them not run quite as hot or not take as much juice, that'll be a lot easier too. So that's coming. We'll get there. But we need to build out our power grid anyway. And it's probably going to be modular nuclear and probably all of the above, right? We'll probably do all sorts of different energy, all different types of energy generation. We need to do it. We need to be smart about it. We need to have long-term investment. We need to make sure that the people that are utilizing it are paying for it. And it doesn't just fall on the backs of the everyday mom and pops that are out there paying their light bill every month. They shouldn't have to pay for the data centers by themselves. The data centers got to be part of this process.
Perfect. Kevin, you got any other I'm going to let him end it with a question. Do you got anything else for Jay before we wind it down?
Yeah,
hey,
Hold on.
I got a question. Do you disagree with me on that? Do you think the data center should have some skin in the game as far as the energy creation? Do you think
who are you asking?
No, I like what you said there. I think if you're a township and you're having I think you want to try and they have to have a long-term stake in the community and they have to have a long-term, I guess, agenda or some type of syllabus of how they're going to create energy, be a benefit to the community and those types of things. So, I don't know. Like I said, we've had a couple pop up out in our area, Jay, out where we had the house out before. And, that got struck down. The city went nuts. Hell, people went crazy. And they had to move on to a different place. But I don't think they were able to answer the questions from a long-term basis, how they would aid and help the community longer term.
All right, so I'll go ahead. What's my question, Kevin?
My question, Todd, we're back to the investing side. Everyone needs to know this now. Jay is also a card collector and a collectible investor. So Jay takes some of that money from selling farms, puts them into some collector cards and things like that. Hey, Todd, question for you, buddy boy. You're on the forefront of all this technology. You on Whatnot yet?
You tell me what it is, and I'll go do some research.
I knew it. That's what I thought, Jay. That's what I thought. So we went to lunch the other day, Jay and I. We go to lunch, once a month at least, and we talk about hell, we're investing, and we're both collectors, which we invest in the collectible markets. And Jay says, hey, Trump, you need to get on this Whatnot. It's an app. Go out there, download it. You guys will all like it. Trust me, your wise life. It's Whatnot, Todd. And you know how we used to go to auctions?
Is that the auction one, Kevin?
Yeah.
I did download that a few bucks. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, but you can get on there and see. There's people on there auctioning off. You name it, anything, everything.
Right.
Jay and I were on there looking at pack break. People breaking packs. You can buy the packs, before they break them, and you get the cards that are. There's investments play there. Yeah, Jay. What do you're a hobby collector. You got comics too, Jay, or do you got just cards?
No. I grew up buying and selling stuff to make money. And, buying and selling cattle, worked well for me growing up on the farm because I could feed them for free. And, but you can only feed so many, right? So I figured out I could, buy and sell cards that nobody wanted, and that paid for a year of college. I think I'm convinced I took them down and sold them to a show in Kansas City that Kevin probably is the one that bought them. But I sold all my cards to go pay for a year part of a year of college, and when I got out and graduated, was practicing, it would be fun for me to, I went and started picking up a few of them. So I've gone back and kind of bought some of the ones I had. So that's what I've kind of done. And then, but I'm a piker compared to Kevin. Kevin's a volume buyer of high quality products. I kind of have the lower end stuff that I kind of enjoy. My whole thing on cards or any collectibles is only focus on things you enjoy. And don't focus on, trying to hit a grand slam home run. Try to focus on things you enjoy. And if you enjoy the specific player or the specific, genre of card or comic or art or gun or whatever you like, sculptures, get what you enjoy. Don't buy it because you think you're going to make money on it. Buy it because you enjoy it. And then if you make money on it, all the better. When it comes to cards, really simple. Stay with the GOATs, stay with the greatest players of all time, and stay with quality over quantity. And that's what I tell people.
Todd, Jay's a big historian, too. He loves history and things with a story and Wild West and, a lot of that. Yeah, I see all the stuff he's got. Right. Like Muhammad Ali to the horse racing to all the other cool stuff. So, yeah, he's like us. He loves those collectibles.
Love the history. I love the history. And it's fun. But like I said, you invest in the things you enjoy, and then that way, if you make money on it, great. But if you don't, you enjoy them.
Yeah.
Well, cool. Kevin, going back to what's not real quick, I did, because when we were looking at maybe selling, flipping stuff, selling it on Facebook or eBay, whatever, I found that app, and I went there, and I love old rare books and stuff and antique books. And so I went on a couple of those things. They do those live auctions or sales.
Yeah, yeah.
And, dude, some of them were so, I'm just going to say, weirded me out. I felt like I was in places I shouldn't be. Like, I was on an app I shouldn't be on, because these places were like back rooms, and it was freaky, but I loved the app.
Yeah, people just pop up in their garage and start auctioning shit off.
Oh, it was crazy.
Well, one of the guys I play poker with, Jay, Friday night, he came over last Friday, and he was over here messing with us, and I said, what are you on your phone on the whole? And he's like, I'm on this Whatnot. And I said, oh, God, not the Whatnot thing again. And he said, but he owns they own a few buildings, and he's got one of them that's an antique mall or whatever. But he's like, man, these people talked us into using it. We auctioned off 347 items one night. They started it, they put them on a scale. Like, every item goes on a scale, and they kind of tell you what your shipping's going to be. And then they'd auction off, and it started. It had 10 seconds, And everything started at a dollar. And then when someone bids, it adds another 7 seconds or another 7 cents. But they went through 347 items in, no time. And I said, how'd you guys do? And he said, oh, shit, we did great. We made more money selling things on there than we've ever made. And I said, no shit. And he's like, but what we failed to realize was, boxing up 347 individual items.
Ouch.
And putting labels on them to mail them out. They're like, oh, my gosh, we've been working for days on this thing. But I asked him what the rake was on the platform. I think they're taking 5% is what he told me of the auction they did. So I've never done it. I've never put things out there to auction, just to let everyone know. I bought a few things off there. Michelle's bought a couple of things. But yeah, he actually did an auction on there, and I think they raked 5%, which is pretty darn good if you think about it, compared to what a lot of them want to charge you. So, I don't know. Might be another platform people looking to just get out there in the bar and sell a few things or sell stuff off. Might be a play for them, or if you just want to look and something to do. So,
it's easier than eBay. I've never sold on it. I've only bought a couple of things on it. I mentioned to Kevin because it's not publicly traded, and I think if there was a way to put money in it, it would be interesting. Jake Paul, I guess, put a bunch of money into it. But I think it's doing really well as a business because it's giving people a way to jump out there and empty their inventory and have a system that's going to have the payment come in and payment get processed and accountability if you don't deliver the product. So it's an interesting model, kind of a derivation of eBay or Facebook Marketplace or whatever you use.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I agree. So another bring a trailer type play, right? Somebody.
There we go. That's exactly right. Exactly right.
Yeah. So cool, guys. Well, God.
All right, I've got one hot take for you. You ready?
This is it, Jay. We're going to end it with this. Go right ahead, my friend.
So, you know, I always try to – I learn a lot from a lot of people I work with. And several years ago, I was out working with one of the smartest farmers I've ever worked with. And, you know, he is like a classical scholar, but you wouldn't know that meeting him. And I said, how do you do it? And he said, here's my secret. And he bought the family Spotify, which a lot of us have. But if you have the family Spotify and you're the organizer, you get 15 hours of free books a month. And what he does is instead of podcasts and news recycled every 20 minutes, he does those 15 hours and listens to a book every month while he's working. So I started doing that, and it's, you know, you can do Audible, you can do whatever you want, but Spotify, if you're the family organizer, you get 15 hours free. And I got to tell you, it's a good way to knock out a book every month.
Wow.
And the price is right. And that has been a good hack for me that I picked up from a very smart gentleman I've known for a long time. I thought I'd share it with you.
Yeah, heck yeah. Cool.
I think it's a great idea. What was replaced with the time you're now spending reading a book? What was replaced? Doom scrolling?
It's when I drive. I do it when I drive. So,
oh, drive. I'm sorry. Okay, cool.
So it's I'm not listening to as many, not listening to the news, recycled news over and over again.
Gotcha.
You probably not. I'm not listening as much sports talk. Probably.
There you go. No, cool, man. That's good stuff. Reading that opens the mind. Reading old books. I like reading old books, too. Kevin and I talk about that all the time. Old ideas, the applications. Well, Jay, listen, brother, thank you so much, man. Great insight, great time as always, and we will definitely have you on. I did not get to succession planning, which I would love to touch on next time. So appreciate it. Thank you so much, and we'll talk to you guys soon.
I apologize to the listeners because I forgot we were on a podcast for a while. I thought I was just talking to Kevin and Todd. So there you go.
All right, buddy. I'll talk to you.
Have a good one.